Jim Daniels.
Hey, thanks for making us a part of your day. Appreciate that. It's NBC Sports Radio, NBCSportsRadio.com. I'm Jim Daniels here every Sunday morning where we like to kick the box score aside and take a different look at the sports world. Some of the individuals and stories are making news and headlines that don't have to do with the final score. So it means we don't necessarily have to get into the annihilation that Oklahoma faced at the hands of Villanova. Wow, biggest lopsided victory in history. But again, it's not about the numbers for this one, more about the stories this morning. On the program, a couple of things as usual. We'll speak to the professor, Rick Horro. He joins us every week, and we talk about the deal-making and endorsements and things like that in sports, the dollars, if you will, the sports world. Our interview this morning is a great one. You're going to love this. Jonathan Hawk has written and directed a sports documentary about Major League Baseball, and it's called Fastball, and it's all about his love of pitchers. So on this, the opening day of the 2016 Major League Baseball season, a fun interview with Jonathan Hawk. That's a little bit later on. And of course, Pete Fox always joins us for the last part of Speaking of Sports, and we get into some of the issues. I think we may talk a little bit of Major League Baseball today since we've got that on the list. And yeah, if you're not aware that it was starting today, let me just tell you briefly. There are a handful of games, an American League game, which is Toronto and Tampa. There is a National League game that is a St. Louis and Pittsburgh. And then we have a couple of interleague games. One of them is a World Series rematch, and that's the feature game of the evening. Later on tonight, 8:35 p.m. Eastern is when the Mets and the Kansas City Royals will play. And then also for your entertainment, you might even call this a Cactus League interleague or a Cactus interleague game, okay? That's the Cubs and the Angels. So Major League Baseball in full swing starting today. Yeah, before we even have our national champion for March Madness, we're going to have Major League Baseball up and rolling. So let's get to it. Here's some of the stories that I want to share with you this morning. And the first one is about, you know, there's so many superhero movies out there. And the latest is Batman versus Superman, and they've just gotten into it. Well, apparently, Stephen Gostkowski of the New England Patriots, he's a crime fighter as well. Why is he a crime fighter? Well, actually, a thief broke into his truck and stole. Actually, it was a Nike book bag that had his iPad in it. And apparently, a fellow by the name of Ralphie Olivero is the not-so-smart criminal that broke into his truck. How do we know that it's Ralphie? Well, Gostkowski reported that somebody stole his iPad while his truck was parked. Then when he noticed a couple of days later, he logged into his iCloud account. He found half a dozen selfie photos of some young man that he'd never seen before. Somebody had logged into his iCloud account and posted these pictures. Well, apparently what happened here is Gostkowski used the Track My Phone software to help catch this guy who had taken this iPad and used it to take a bunch of selfies of himself. You know, maybe he could have got in front of a mirror to make it more incriminating. I suppose if you got in front of a mirror and took a selfie of yourself taking the picture with the stolen iPad, that would have been more incriminating. But this was incriminating enough. I mean, come on. This is King Kong stupid. You stole an iPad, then you took selfies and you loaded it to the iCloud? Wow. Anyway, Gostkowski winds up getting his gear back, and I'm sure probably one of those gold stars from the police department. I don't know if that's much as Gostkowski being a crime fighter or if that is, hold on, standby, what's his name? Let's get your name in there. Or if that's 19-year-old Ralphie Olivero being one of the dumbest crooks that you're ever going to hear about. Is that crazy or what? We had April Fool's Day, and there were a couple of beauties in the sports world. My favorite has got to be this one. It's not, you know, I don't want to get into all of the April Fool's gags and jokes that I saw because there were some of them, and they were all over the place. But Le'Veon Bell tweeted at 6:24 in the morning on April 1st, "It's been a great run with Steeler Nation. I'll always have love for my former teammates, coaches, and for all of the fans, but got to move on." Well, about 95 minutes later, Le'Veon Bell tweeted, "LOL, some fell for it, some didn't, but anyways, happy April Fools." So Le'Veon Bell putting a shock into Steeler Nation. I thought immediately of the Steeler fans that I know in the world. And can you imagine the shock of Le'Veon Bell? He's been what? He's been traded. What? What happened? Yeah, Le'Veon Bell has not been traded, and that's bad news, I think, for the for the Cincinnati Bengals. You know, there was something that happened in the NBA that some are calling Towelgate. I don't think it's that big a deal. However, I did see on Instagram and in our website as well, I think carried this story along with the video, of and this happened in Cleveland. Hey, what do you know? Drama with the Cavaliers, where Tyronn Lue is having to deal with Towelgate. Iman Shumpert, in the video shown on our website and a lot of other places, Twitter, Instagram, and that, is shown in this very short clip tossing a towel, after a huddle, tossing the towel onto the shoulders of the new head rookie coach, Tyronn Lue. And this is the loss that the Cavaliers suffered to the Rockets on Tuesday night. Well, big deal. It shouldn't have been a big deal and wouldn't have been anything if it were handled better by the head coach, who said after the game, quote, when asked about it, I didn't even notice it. Somebody later brought it to my attention. It's not something I'm concerned with. Him and me are cool. When did it happen? Close quote. Look, all you've got to do, I mean, you're the one that pulled it off your shoulder. You're seen doing that in the video. I mean, all you've got to say is, what, we broke the huddle, he tossed it. It's no big deal. You guys are making something out of nothing. Next question. Then it goes away. But when you get into, oh, no, no, somebody had to bring it to my attention. When did it happen? Now you're playing dumb. I don't know if you're trying to, what, protect the player? I don't really understand exactly what Tyronn Lue is doing other than, look, own it. Own it. It's okay. It's not a big deal. Say that it's okay and it's not a big deal. Don't go to, someone had to bring it to my attention. Me and him are cool. Oh, when did that happen? You know, like you don't know. I mean, now all of a sudden you become the news reporter who just heard a report about a water bong being found at the apartment. What exactly is a water bong? You know, it's come on. You know what it is. Don't play dumb. Own it and make it go away. But again, rookie head coach, make rookie mistakes. Speaking of rookies, well, this guy's not a rookie. He spent a couple of years in Cleveland first, but Johnny Manziel continues to stay in the news because Johnny Manziel apparently not concerned at all about all the reports and the fact that his career is over. No, over the past 5 days, Johnny Manziel has fired up the party train once again with stops in Los Angeles and Las Vegas. Apparently, he went to hit up a club in Vegas. That wasn't good enough. After that, after being at a Chris Brown concert, hit another club in Vegas. Manziel showed off some of his dance moves and his champagne bottle etiquette. I think a lot of us remember his champagne bottle etiquette when he was riding an inflatable swan. That was in the rookie season, or maybe right after he'd been signed by the Browns. But if you haven't noticed, what happens in Vegas to Johnny Manziel doesn't stay in Vegas. It goes everywhere. But Johnny Manziel, next up, taking pictures of himself, selfies, in another Vegas club. Then, after Vegas, Manziel hit up a club in Hollywood where he definitely wasn't the biggest name. TMZ was there to report that Selena Gomez and Nick Jonas, one of the Jonas brothers, some of the Jenners, those people were there. And although Drew Rosenhaus is out in the world, that's Johnny's new agent is Drew Rosenhaus, he insists that there are several, quote, several teams that are interested in Manziel. I think with every one of these stories, it becomes harder and harder to believe that that's a true story. You know, that's sad, but it's not a jaw dropper. This is sad and a jaw dropper, and it's the story about Lamar Odom, okay? It's pretty well documented what happened to Lamar Odom not too long ago. He was found unresponsive in a brothel in Nevada. Well, just 5 months after he got up from death's door in a brothel in Nevada, he decided to go on have a couple of cocktails. Yeah, the former Laker and Clipper rang in Easter Sunday morning at the Johnny O'Brien Bar in Sherman Oaks, California. That's just over the hill from Hollywood. TMZ reported that Odom, who arrived at the Irish pub with a couple of his buddies right around midnight, reportedly bought three Remy Martin cognac drinks before taking off just about an hour later. He attended an Easter church service in Agoura Hills with Kourtney Kardashian's son, Mason, and was also at some church services with Khloe. You know, why he's hanging out with his estranged folks, I don't know. You would think maybe because of the support and all of that. I wonder what these people who've been supporting him and helping him and trying to get back on the right track think of him going out at 1 o'clock in the morning and downing a bunch of cognacs. I mean, really? You were teetering on the edge of death? People were wondering if you would ever speak coherently again, let alone be able to walk around loose in the world? And this is it. 5 months later, oh, yeah, it's all good. Give me a cognac. No big deal. Just having a little casual drink. Wow, that's... Should I go all the way to the pathetic for that? I think it probably is. Wow, Lamar Odom. I guess it's all good, right? Coming up next on the show, it's our conversation with Rick Horro. The professor will break down some dollars for us. Hopefully no cognac involved. NBC Sports Radio and NBCSportsRadio.com. NBC Sports Radio, NBCSportsRadio.com. The mobile app is yours free. Google Play Store. You can also get involved in on-demand or podcasting. You can have it sent things straight to your email if you want. Appreciate it. Jim Daniels with you for Speaking of Sports. And time for us to bring in the professor. We talk the business and marketing issues when it comes to sports with Rick Horro. He joins us now. And I guess the first thing I want to ask you, since we're now just down to one last game in March Madness, do you have any teams still alive for the championship game?
Yeah, Duke. Oh.
No, your daughter goes to Duke. I know that. No. Never mind.
Yeah, no, you know what? I was there last night, which was, I'm not sure what's worse, is to get eliminated in Sweet 16 or play like Oklahoma did last night. That's a kind of an issue as far as legacy is concerned. I'm getting on a plane to go to Indy for the Connecticut iconic Women's Final Four and then the Masters. Mm-hmm. So it's a big 5 days.
The Masters, boy, we could talk about that one all day long, too. But let's start with the Horro Sports Brief, which is talking about sometimes sports are more than just a game. You talk about the fact that President Obama and Cuban President Raul Castro sitting next to each other watching the Rays and the Cuban national team play. Are we going to see more of this? And I mean a lot more of this?
Yeah, a lot more of this. And the bottom line of all of it now is the hard part really starts. You know, season opens, we take some of the attention off of that for a little while. But then the Cuban Federation and Major League Baseball's international guys, to be sure, are talking about how to make a deal, a comprehensive one. Player exchange, minor league team maybe, spring training on a regular basis, regular season games, and it's possible even to talk about big league down the road. The Cuban infrastructure is not ready for it, and Miami still can't believe that's happening, but they'll, you know, have to get over it commercially. So it's the beginning of a long process.
Let's move to the NFL because the owners had their meeting, and one of the owners, Jerry Jones, this is a guy that's not bashful about his opinion on any level, but his comments last week at the owners' meeting about disavowing the link between football and CTE really made headlines quickly. I mean, this is something that everyone at least is supposed to, on the outside, supposed to show major concern. I'm actually a little bit surprised. No, I'm a lot surprised at Jerry Jones and his quote saying when asked about is there enough data to establish a connection between CTE and playing football, he replied flatly, no, that's absurd. And then Woody Johnson also jumped in and said, whether I agree with the statement made by Senior Vice President of Health and Safety for NFL football, Jeff Miller, whether I agree with that or not, I'll leave that to the neurologist. Isn't this a bad look for both of these guys?
Well, probably a better look for Woody Johnson, to be honest about it, because his context was, I'm not a scientist.
Yeah.
We've got to stay one step ahead of the scientists. We'll pay the scientists, and whatever the scientists tell us, we've got to figure out if it's the right group of scientists. So, yeah, it's a firestorm, and it's certainly not a firestorm about nothing. It's a how do you negotiate the next deal? The settlement has already been done on the concussion lawsuits, the core of them. More suits are filed regularly. And the real issue is how do you make sure that everybody understands that they're all on the same page of getting out ahead of the science at the same time of it and not covering up? And whether it's the right thing to do or whether it's the money, or whether it's the fact that you better do it or the lawyers will be all over you, I think the NFL has seen a sea change over the last couple of years, and they're moving forward on this stuff.
All right, let's stay with the NFL, and bad news for old-school Ram fans. Apparently, a lot of old-school Ram fans would like to see the Rams go back to their original blue and white colors. However, the time for change has passed, according to those in the know at the NFL office. So it'll be no new colors for the Rams, not this year, but not even next year either, right?
Well, but the year after, certainly. It's not those only, you know, the old-school purists. It's the people with any sensibility about that gold and blue and, yeah. And you know, they're great colors, but not on the same day or in the same uniform. And so, you know, the bottom line of all of this is that the NFL has a long process. It's logo development, it's merchandise. All the partners are in it to win it themselves in the same group. And so part of the issue is if you have the stadium logo on it, is it the Rams and Raiders, Rams and Chargers? So it's all tied into the bigger issue. And for the Rams fans who are the old traditionalists, just be happy you got the team back.
All right, Rick Horro is our guest. We talk the business of sports with the professor every week at this time. And you mentioned that you're on your way to the women's final, UConn. Apparently, UConn, or I should say, according to the Associated Press, the numbers for the NCAA women's basketball tournament continue to go down. I think one of the reasons why it goes down is because UConn is too good. I've seen a number of stories over the past week or so talking about the fact that it's because it's not competitive, because they always win, because it's always blowouts. Some of their games this year were absolutely ridiculous when you look at some of the scores. You think, wait a minute, that's a typo. That can't be right. UConn being too good, is that a problem?
Well, there is parity in women's basketball. It's UConn and then everybody else. So, you know, listen, the first few rounds, when you look at the overall numbers, the UConn games themselves are up in the 46% or so increase. So people want to tune in early and see maybe the best athletic team of all time. That is somewhat important. Breanna Stewart winning four MVPs in a row may happen, might happen, probably happen. Team winning four national championships in a row undefeated. But then when you win by 52 and 51 in the first and second round, you got some issues with that. And so how do you change the way you can't? Because everybody admires excellence. And the bottom line is Gino Auriemma and the team is excellent. I decided to go. It's not on the way to the Masters, but it's only like half inch on the map. Depends on how big the map is. And the reason I'm going is because I really wanted to see excellence, honestly. I want to test the business of women's sports. But I'm a believer in at least, you know, a couple of games a year, let's put it that way.
Yeah, you know what, and there's nothing wrong with excellence. I saw Gino being interviewed earlier in the week talking about the fact that I've never even heard of having to defend being too good before, which is kind of a head-scratcher. But staying with college athletics, looks like the college, or I should say the collegiate conference television networks, these things are supposed to help supply some substantive revenue, yet you've got some people that are upset about this, like Oklahoma State University football coach Mike Gundy, who lashed out at UT for the Longhorn Network. Look, is it time to just level the playing field? Should every one of these big D1 programs have their own network?
Well, or they have the conferences do it, because the networks are only as good as the scheduling amongst the conferences. David Boren, the University of Oklahoma president, who's like licking his wounds from last night about another issue, but he said that if Texas doesn't fall to the Longhorn Network in a number of years, Oklahoma may move to the Pac-12 or SEC. It's not a threat. It's economic reality. So most of these conference networks are done because they want to increase awareness and they want to increase revenue and level the playing field because they distribute the revenue equally. But if the Longhorns are making $15, $20 million more a year than everybody else, then it's time to do something about it.
All right, let's get to the UFC, actually, a landslide vote in the New York State Assembly legalizing mixed martial arts. I mean, well, okay, gosh, talking out of time. I never have enough time with you. One of these days, when you're out here in the West Coast, you're going to have to do the whole show with me.
I'll do the whole show with you anytime, and have a really, really good week. We'll talk Masters next week.
That sounds great. Looking forward to it. The professor, Rick Horro, thanks once again for joining us on NBC Sports Radio. Boy, my time flies when I talk to him. Coming up next, you're going to like this one, baseball fans. Jonathan Hawk's got a movie out called Fastball. You'll hear about it next.
It's Jim Daniels.
Thanks for making us a part of your day. Appreciate that. I'm Jim Daniels. This is Speaking of Sports, where we like to throw the box score aside and talk to some folks that are making news in the sports world without picking up a bat or a ball or a puck. You know, we're going to talk Major League Baseball now because, yep, the Major League Baseball season is here. The 2016 season will kick off in just a few hours. Actually, first one on the slate today is going to be St. Louis at Pittsburgh at 1 o'clock. At 3 o'clock, the Cubs will visit the Angels. At 4 o'clock, Toronto will be at Tampa. And at 8:35... on the four-letter network in primetime, a World Series rematch is going to be the Mets and the Kansas City Royals. So baseball in full swing. Joining us this morning now is Jonathan Hawk. He is the writer and director of the new documentary film Fastball. This one is really, really cool stuff. The film, which premiered at last year's Tribeca Film Festival, tells the story of famous pitchers throughout Major League Baseball history, the science behind the perfect pitch and how the game has changed over the years. It features, well, a whole lot of people. As a matter of fact, Jonathan Hawk managed to get a hold of actually former players and current players. Current players like Justin Verlander, Bryce Harper, people like that. Former players like Goose Gossage, Nolan Ryan. Anyway, Jonathan joins us now to talk about the film Fastball. Welcome to NBC Sports Radio, Jonathan.
Great to be with you.
Great to have you with us, especially on this opening day, 2016. Now, obviously, you're a huge, huge baseball fan, so I'm going to ask this question right out of the gate. Who was your favorite hurler as a boy?
When I was a boy, Ron Guidry of the Yankees was my favorite pitcher. And he came into his prime just as I was sort of in my prime of being a fan at age 13, 14, that was an extraordinary time to be a Yankee fan and this undersized, scrawny little lefty who was just, you know, striking out 250 guys and just unbelievable excitement when he pitched. That was when the rhythmic clapping with two strikes that was is all over baseball now. That started with Guidry against the Angels one night in June when he struck out 18, and the fans started doing that spontaneously in the middle of the game. It was incredible.
You know, myself, I grew up on the West Coast. You're obviously a Yankee fan, if that's one of your favorites. I grew up Dodger out here in the West Coast, so did my brother, and he and I both were, he was a Koufax guy. I was a Drysdale guy. Sandy Koufax, though, one of the greats in the all-time. Where does Sandy work his way into the film?
Yeah, well, Koufax is what represents to us what happens when the guy with the magic in his arm figures out how to harness it, and it never got better than Koufax those years after he got it together. And we have a segment of the film called Perfect, and it's about the perfect game in 1965 against the Cubs at Dodger Stadium. And the thing about that game was that it was not televised. And for decades, it was assumed there was no footage of Koufax throwing his perfect game. Well, it turns out the Dodgers trainer, a guy named Bill Buehler, was an amateur film buff and had a 16-millimeter camera and went behind home plate and was filming. And nobody knew, of course, that when he started filming that he was documenting history.
Right.
But here was Sandy Koufax throwing his perfect game until Bill Buehler ran out of film.
No!
And so you have the ninth inning, and all you have is that there were 29,000 people in the stadium, and that's it, except for, thank heaven, for Vin Scully, who delivered the announcer's equivalent of a perfect game in the ninth inning. And in the film, we just show the final out of the game when Koufax strikes out Harvey Keene with just a lot of black screen and just like you're listening on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
And then some still images come up. And the magic in that moment and the, you know, when the guy with the lightning in his arm makes it happen and fulfills his potential, it's so mythic. And when you've got a voice like Vin Scully's making it real for you, you just close your eyes and listen, and that's the feeling that we all go into the season hoping for a moment like that as baseball fans. And that's what Thomas Tall, the producer, and I wanted to do, was to make a film that every spring you'll want to throw it in the DVD player to get psyched for the season.
Right, right, exactly right. Jonathan Hawk has written and directed the documentary MLB film Fastball. He joins us this morning. You know, Jonathan, I had the opportunity also growing up in Southern California to see Nolan Ryan actually quite a bit when he was with the Angels. I lived only a few miles from Angel Stadium at the time, and that was, you know, you're talking back in the day here now, that was cheap entertainment when you were a kid, a $5, $4 view-level ticket up there. And we got to watch this guy all, you know, a great deal. He had a lot of success with the Angels. Where does the express rate in the film?
Well, Nolan is the guy. And first of all, you talk about a labor of love when, you know, he's not known as the most gregarious guy. And, well, I'll tell you what, we spent 2 hours sits together in his office when he was with the Texas Rangers just talking about the fastball, and it was as much fun as I've ever had talking to anybody. I mean, it was like going to the mountaintop and seeing the guru and, getting the truth about it. And Nolan was incredible. The interview in the film is incredible. And what his career, when you have this perspective that we have on it now, was so extraordinary. I mean, here's a guy in 74 pitching for the Angels, pitching against Louis Tiant in August, I think, summer, hot summer night. The game goes 15 innings. Nolan pitches into the 13th, strikes out 19, walks 10, throws 232 pitches, and then on 3 days rest comes back Friday night and throws a 1-0 shutout. And Whitey Herzog points out that during that stretch with the Angels, Nolan pitched, took a lead into the seventh inning 77 times and completed all 77 games and won them all. So he was his own closer. And, you talk about a guy whose life took on the character of myth. I mean, what Nolan Ryan did after his 40th birthday, most guys would love to do in their 20s. I mean, striking out 300 and leading the league in ERA and just unbelievable.
Man, you know what? I'd never heard that stat about Nolan Ryan before, about being his own closer, but it kind of seemed like that. Seems like he finished every game I ever watched him play. All right, back to your Yankees now, and let's talk about Goose Gossage. He was one of the game's great, great relievers, and he had a moment in the World Series with my Dodgers and a guy by the name of Ron Say that I don't think anybody's going to forget.
Yeah, that was at Dodger Stadium, and that's in the film. And Goose talks about our first chapter in the film is about Goose because Hank Aaron said he was the nastiest he ever faced.
Wow, really?
And if Hank Aaron says it, then you just put it in the bank. This was nasty. And, Eddie Murray, talking about Goose, said, with his windup, he had such a violent delivery, and he twisted and his glove hand was flying all over the place, so you didn't see the ball. Some guys you can pick it up before they release it, but you had no idea where the ball was with Goose. And he said you just prayed, you just stood there in the batter's box and prayed he had home plate lined up, because there was nothing you could do if he didn't. And as Ron Say learned the hard way, fortunately he didn't get seriously hurt. But I remember everybody's heart stopped, and it was just like, oh my God, did he kill a man? That was the Goose. And one thing that amazed me about these Hall of Famers, we interviewed about 20 Hall of Famers in the film, as well as a lot of the top players today. And the fear, the current guys don't admit to it, but the older guys do. They say the fear that you had getting in the box against Nolan Ryan or Bob Gibson or Goose Gossage or even Doc Gooden. Eddie Murray talks about he could have sworn he felt the pitch on his mustache, that he didn't even see the ball. He just felt it, the wind in his mustache. So he said that's a scary moment right there. And they talk about not wanting to die. Actually, Bryce Harper is the only one who admits that kind of fear against Aroldis Chapman. Says the first thing I'm thinking, you go into some guys, you're thinking about your mechanics, you're thinking about the game situation. When he steps in against Chapman, he's just thinking, I don't want to die today out here. So it's, because the ball does disappear on the batters. It's traveling faster than your eye can follow it when it gets up around 100. So when the missile's coming at you and you lose sight of it, that's a scary moment.
Well, and no question, Jonathan Hawk is the writer-director of Fastball. And let's talk one more batter here before I let you go. Derek Jeter is another player that you sat down with. He had an incredible career. Obviously, he was a tremendous hitter. Who did Derek Jeter struggle with?
Well, the at-bat he remembered more than any other for a fastball pitcher was against Troy Percival, talking about your Angels again. And in 95... they were at Yankee Stadium, and Jeter had just been called up. And it was a 3-2 count, and Percival was pitching. And Percival was a hard 98, right?
Oh, yeah.
He was pumping it. And the catcher, you know, had this rookie up there, and Jeter said, looked up at me, and he said, "Well, it's no mystery what he's going to throw now, kid." And he just blew him away with a 3-2 fastball. And Jeter got – it was that last out of the game, and Jeter got sent to the minors the next day. And so he said that at-bat against Troy Percival stayed with him, and, you know, 21 years later, he's still haunted by it.
That's just fantastic stuff. The film sounds like a lot of fun, absolutely terrific stuff for any baseball fan. You've already been through the film festival thing. It's now out there for the public. Where can they find it? Where can we see the film?
So it's on iTunes and Amazon and all that. And it's actually the number one documentary on iTunes.
Oh, nice. Awesome stuff. Jonathan Hawk, writer, director of Fastball. If you're a baseball fan, you're going to want to check this one out. And it's on iTunes, so it's just that easy to find. Jonathan, thanks for spending time with us this morning on NBC Sports Radio. Good luck with the film.
Jim, thank you very much. Hope everybody enjoys it.
I'm sure everybody that is a baseball fan is going to enjoy it. Wow, a film all about hurlers. Fun stuff. It's Speaking of Sports, I'm Jim Daniels. Our show is brought to you this morning by Grainger, serving you with the products you need to help keep your facility running. Call, click, or stop by today. Grainger, for the ones who get it done. Coming up next, we'll visit with Pete Fox. It's NBC Sports Radio and NBCSportsRadio.com. About ready to wrap things up on Speaking of Sports for this April Fool's Weekend, I'm going to call it. Pete Fox in the Update Studio. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. I'm looking forward to that movie Fastball now. Thank you very much for that. That was awesome.
You know what? He was a fun interview. And, God, we could have gone on and on about that. You talk about pitchers and hurlers, you know, over time. It's really an endless conversation. A couple of things that I wanted to bring up with you. Are you watching The People versus O.J. Simpson at all?
No, I didn't get into it the first time around. Sure as heck, I'm not going to get into it with a bunch of guys acting like they were there.
You know about the knife story, though, right?
Yes, indeed.
Well, and Mike Florio posted this just yesterday on our NBC Sports site, that the police have finally confirmed that the knife found in the O.J. Simpson property is not the murder weapon. Wow, no kidding, huh?
I have a buddy that suggested that Johnny Cochran and his team went to OJ's house, took all of the knives in the house out of the drawers, and just planted them all over the yard as a distracting.
According to the Associated Press, the Los Angeles Police Department have determined that the knife found years ago is not, in fact, the murder weapon. But the story, I think, here is that there are different versions of the story and the accounts of the knife. And the reason why I bring this up is because isn't this the exact same kind of thing as to why O.J. Simpson wound up getting off the hook all those years ago? Is because of mishandling of evidence? And here we are 20 years later, and they're still mishandling evidence?
Yeah, it's funny, but the part to me that is the most surprising is that, so what if they did find the DNA? Would that have filled in all the blank spots for us and answered all the questions and made us then feel comfortable that OJ, in fact, did do it? I don't understand what people – it wouldn't be like they could go put him in jail again for that.
No, it's double jeopardy. They've right. said a couple of times, and that was part of the whole disconnect with the story, is that – that this cop tried to turn it in, and they said to him, "Oh, well, no need to turn that in anymore. It's over with. He's already been acquitted. You can't have double jeopardy, so no big deal." But now they're saying that he did try and turn it in. I find it more than amusing that the same LAPD that couldn't get it right 20 years ago, now with even this silly story of, "Oh, look, a knife found," all these years later,
I'm
still can't handle the evidence.
I'm going to save it for a memento and then frame it when I retire. That'll be cool.
Scottie Pippen, loose in the world, saying that the 96 Bulls would not only beat but sweep the Golden State Warriors. Is that just get off my lawn stuff?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where you expect him to say that. Uh-huh. What else is he going to say? No, that Warriors team would smoke us. You know, I think the pounding of your chest by an old guy is exactly what you expect when your team was that good, and they're following in the long line of great Dolphins that do the same thing, which is now
so
led
true.
By Mercury Morris. I think it's interesting because is he crazy? I mean, they would at least win a couple of games.
He also said he'd hold Steph Curry under 20 points. Yeah, you might do that in a game. All right, Pete.
Good luck.
Thanks. Yeah, right. But good luck. Thanks very much. Appreciate it. Always enjoy having you on the program. That's going to do it for Speaking of Sports today. Have yourself a wonderful, wonderful opening day for Major League Baseball. We'll talk to you next weekend right here on NBC Sports Radio and NBCSportsRadio.com. Coop is next.